Dr. William Luther Pierce, 2002. Espionage and Anthrax.
Hello. Let's talk about the mass media again today, specifically about the consequences of the Jewish control of the media, the sort of thing that Billy Graham and Richard Nixon saw taking America down the drain 30 years ago. I raise this subject with every journalist who comes to my office for an interview. It's clearly not something they like to talk about, but I try to draw them out anyway. I've said this to you before, and I'll say it again now. Journalists are the most lemming-like people I have met. They're not stupid, but they absolutely will not say anything politically incorrect, even when we're off camera. They always toe the party line. They believe that they're being quite candid with me when they say that Fox News is right-wing compared to the other news channels, and that perhaps that's because Rupert Murdoch, who owns Fox, isn't a Jew. They claim that these small differences in the way the various media report the news prove that there's plenty of diversity and freedom of expression in the media. I respond to them by saying that any differences in bias between Fox News and CNN are pretty small, and that I can learn what the Jewish party line is on any particular issue as well by listening to Fox as I can by listening to CNN. Rupert Murdoch himself may not be a Jew, but his operation is staffed from top to bottom with Jews, and his programming is about as Jewish as that on the other channels. When I say that, they pretend that they don't understand. Perhaps I shouldn't be surprised that they won't tell me anything, even in private, that would get them fired and blacklisted if their Jewish bosses found out about it. Anyway, let's start today with a couple of very recent examples of media bias. Perhaps you heard about the case that made a few headlines last week in Fort Worth, Texas, and was very briefly reported by other media around the country. That's the case of the 25-year-old black woman who, driving under the influence of drugs, hit a white pedestrian, 37-year-old Gregory Biggs, with her car on a Fort Worth street. The impact broke Biggs's legs and threw his body up onto the hood of the black woman's car. His head and shoulders went through the windshield on the passenger side. He was cut by the windshield and, because of his broken legs, was unable to extricate himself, but otherwise he suffered no life-threatening injuries. After hitting Biggs, the black woman drove home with him stuck in her windshield and begging for help. She parked her car in her garage and closed the garage door so that neighbors could not hear Biggs's cries for help. Then she went into her house, had sex with her boyfriend, and took some more drugs. From time to time during the next 3 days, as Biggs slowly bled to death and went into shock, the black woman went into her garage to watch him wriggling, half on the hood of her car and half stuck through the broken windshield, and listened to him begging for help. When Biggs finally died, the black woman and a boyfriend pulled his body out of the windshield, put him in the trunk of the boyfriend's car, and dumped his body in a vacant lot. If you want to read more of the grisly details, you should be able to find them at the website of the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. To me, the most important detail is that no news medium mentioned the race of either the killer or the victim. That information wasn't even explicitly in the Star-Telegram, but fortunately, photographs of the killer and her victim were. Now, you know what the party line is. Race wasn't mentioned because it's irrelevant. One person killed another person in an especially gruesome and callous manner, and race had nothing to do with it. That's the party line. Now, ask yourself this question. Suppose a white man had hit a black woman with his car and then had driven home with her wriggling in his windshield and had watched her slowly die over the next 3 days while listening to her cries for help, taking time off occasionally to have sex with his girlfriend. After the black woman was dead, the white man got a white friend to help him dump her corpse in a vacant lot. Do you believe that the media, in reporting the story after the white man's eventual arrest, would think that the race of the killer and that of the victim were irrelevant? Hey, you know the answer. Every major media outlet in the country would be screaming about white racism and the callous indifference of whites to the suffering of blacks. You know it. And here's an update on a story about Jewish mega-swindlers we covered several weeks ago. This one came from New York 2 weeks ago. A bribery case involving New York City's real estate tax assessors was uncovered that cost New Yorkers more than $1 billion. A number of people were arrested, including 13 out of the 38 tax assessors in Manhattan's real estate tax department. The interesting thing about this case, besides the fact that such a huge amount of money was taken, is that everyone involved is a Jew. The real estate owners, the assessors, and the go-betweens. Here's the way it worked. The Jewish owner of a piece of Manhattan real estate would receive his property tax bill from the tax assessor's office. That bill might be several $1 million on a large office building or hotel. The owner would take the bill to any one of several Jewish tax consultants. Three of these consultants arrested on February 25th were Albert Schussler, Joel Edelstein, and Alan Edelstein, all of whom formerly had worked for the city as assessors. The consultant would then visit the Jew in the assessor's office who had made the assessment. The consultant would give the assessor a bribe, perhaps $10,000, and then the assessor would discover that he had made an error in the assessment. A new tax bill would be issued, perhaps $1 million less than the original one. The consultant would then collect his consulting fee, perhaps $50,000, from the property owner. The property owner would have a net saving of $950,000 in this transaction, and the city would have a net loss of $1 million. Investigators estimate that the swindle has cost the city $160 million in the past 4 years alone, and the swindle has been going on since 1967. They got away with it for so long because everyone involved is a Jew, and they all were covering for each other. And I'll bet you didn't even hear about it. Suppose that in Israel, there lived a small but very cohesive Gentile minority, just 2.5% of the Israeli population. And this small Gentile minority somehow managed to be involved in every major swindle in Israel, costing the Israeli people tens of millions of dollars, I guess I should say tens of millions of shekels every year. Do you believe that the Israeli newspapers would fail to mention the Gentile character of all this swindling, just as the newspapers over here never, and I mean never, mention or draw any conclusions from the Jewishness of the biggest swindles in America? Well, the most interesting current example of media bias in America is the thundering silence of the media in connection with the arrest and deportation during the past few months of approximately 200 Israelis engaged in espionage in this country. It was the largest espionage ring ever broken up in America. But there were no prosecutions and almost no media coverage. The Bush government simply hustled them back to Israel as quickly and quietly as possible, and most of the media kept quiet about it. Most of the media in this country, that is. In Europe, much more was revealed. The big French newspaper, Le Monde, reported last week in its March 5th edition, and I quote, "A vast Israeli espionage network operating on American territory has been broken up," end of quote. Le Monde went on to report the details, citing a confidential U.S. government report that had been obtained by a French group specializing in such acquisitions and posted on the Internet at intelligenceonline.com. This confidential report was prepared for the Justice Department by the Drug Enforcement Administration, the Immigration and Naturalization Service, the FBI, and the Air Force, and a copy of the report used by Le Monde has been declared authentic by the Drug Enforcement Administration. The report details the suspicious activities of a number of young Israelis in the United States, some of them posing as art students and some as sidewalk vendors. They hung around outside sensitive government or military facilities and tried to strike up conversations with government employees. Some of them tried to talk their way past security guards and get into the facilities. Others actually showed up at the homes of government officials and tried to talk their way inside. It was the Drug Enforcement Administration that first became suspicious of their activities early last year. But when it became evident that something more serious was going on, the FBI and other agencies also became involved in the investigation. Eventually, 120 Israelis were arrested and questioned, and it looked as if a major spy scandal, surpassing that of the Jonathan Pollard case, was shaping up. The backgrounds of the arrested Israelis, most of them with military intelligence experience in Israel, just didn't match their claim to be art students or trinket vendors. 6 of the arrested Israelis were found with cell phones that had been purchased for them by a former Israeli vice consul in the United States. Then came September 11th, and suddenly the whole government stance on these arrested Israeli agents changed. Instead of being charged with espionage, they were deported back to Israel for visa violations. After September 11th, the FBI arrested approximately 80 more of the Israeli agents. But like the others, they were quietly deported rather than being prosecuted for espionage. And the media, for the most part, remained silent. One U.S. newspaper that has broken the ban on news about the arrested Israelis is the South Florida Sun Sentinel. Last week, in its March 7th issue, the Sun Sentinel pointed out that the concentration of deported Israeli art students had been especially heavy in precisely those areas where the September 11th hijackers had been living, and in some cases, learning to fly without bothering to learn how to take off or land. More than a third of the Israeli spies in the United States were operating in those communities in Florida where 10 of the 19 Arab hijackers had been living prior to September 11th. At least 5 of the Israeli spies were in the community of Hollywood, Florida, where Mohammed Atta, who coordinated the hijacking operation, and 4 of his Al-Qaeda associates had been living. The South Florida Sun Sentinel was not alone in noting the proximity of the deported Israeli spies to the Al-Qaeda members. Le Monde noted that this coincidence of proximity greatly strengthens the suspicion of European intelligence services that the Israelis were shadowing the Al-Qaeda agents and knew ahead of time what was up. And of course, they kept their own government informed. But Israel did not share its knowledge with the U.S. government. Some allies. Now, if you ask the FBI why it let all of these Israeli spies go, all you will get is the reply that no espionage charges were filed against them. The real question is, why weren't charges filed? You think maybe the FBI wasn't convinced the Israelis were espionage agents? Listen to this. The Israelis posing as art students in South Florida were all affiliated with an outfit named Universal Art, which has an address listed in the town of Sunrise, Florida. Reporters from the Sun Sentinel went to the address, and no one there had ever heard of Universal Art. The officers of Universal Art listed in Florida incorporation papers were two people with Israeli names, Yitzhak Shish and Chava Sagi. No one had ever heard of them either. Now, do you really believe that the FBI wasn't convinced that the deported Israelis were working for the government of Israel as spies? I don't believe it. I'm sure that the FBI knows they were spies, but received orders not to charge them. Why? I'll tell you. If these Israeli spies had been charged with espionage and put on trial, what almost certainly would have come out of the trials is that Israel knew about September 11th ahead of time and deliberately withheld the information from us so that the attacks could be carried out as planned. The media would not have been able to keep the lid on that, and an enormous degree of resentment by the American people against Israel would have been the consequence. So the spies were turned loose and sent home in order not to damage the sympathy of the American people for our gallant little democratic ally, Israel, and so as not to jeopardize the flow of money from the U.S. Treasury to Israel. What do you call that sort of behavior on the part of the Bush government and on the part of the media bosses who have kept the whole business as quiet as possible? I call it treason. Well, this matter of the Israeli spies is quite clear. Another matter on which fewer facts are currently available to the public is that of the anthrax-infected letters that were mailed in this country a few weeks ago. There's a $2.5 million reward for information on the perpetrator, and the FBI has had thousands of agents on the case. Not only has there been no arrest, but there hasn't been much news about the search recently. It certainly is possible that eventually someone will be arrested, but I will not be surprised if no one ever is, and if the government and the media just let the whole matter of anthrax mailings quietly fade away. Why would they do that? Well, perhaps because an arrest would be extremely embarrassing to the media bosses and to the whole tribe to which they belong. It wasn't so long ago that the Jewish media were suggesting that the anthrax mailings probably were the work of right-wingers, of white supremacists, of neo-Nazis. I had reporters coming by my office and asking me questions about these accusations. And then there were headlines, quote, "Pierce denies responsibility for anthrax mailings." Really? I said at the time that I believed this was a deliberate stratagem on the part of the media to misdirect suspicion. Now I am sure of it. If the FBI knows who made the anthrax mailings, but has been ordered not to arrest him, I am sure that it will be for the same reason that the Israeli spies were not prosecuted. Of course, the FBI may not be able to keep a secret that well. The FBI's hand may be forced, and it may have to arrest the perpetrator after all. Let us hope so. But with a government like we have now, nothing, no matter how treacherous or crooked, will surprise me. I'll repeat what I've just said. Over the past year, the FBI rounded up 200 Jewish espionage agents in this country. The FBI knew they were engaged in espionage for the state of Israel. If the FBI had wound up its investigation of this Israeli espionage ring before September 11th, then the arrested Jews might have been charged with espionage and prosecuted. Maybe. After September 11th, however, the Bush government was under great pressure not to do anything that might embarrass Israel. In the first place, the government and the media were desperate to maintain their pretense that the September 11th attack was not a response to the U.S. government's support of Israel. The attack came only because Osama bin Laden is evil and hates our freedom, and it had nothing at all to do with Israel. Getting the lemmings to swallow that lie was hard enough. If it were publicly revealed that Israel knew about the attack in advance and deliberately kept the information from us so that the attack could go ahead. Even the lemmings would be muttering darkly about Jews and their treachery. It was essential to the media Jews to keep that from happening, and the Bush government obediently went along with the cover-up. Now, I have a strong suspicion that for exactly the same reason, the FBI has held off on arresting the person who mailed the anthrax letters. I believe that the FBI knows who it is, but has been ordered not to arrest him because it would be very embarrassing to the Jews. At least, don't arrest him yet, not until the Bush government has finished bombing Israel's enemies in the Middle East. It's not just that I'm a cynical, suspicious bastard. I remember what happened in 1967, for example, when Israel deliberately tried to sink our electronic intelligence ship, the USS Liberty, killing 34 American crewmen in the process so that they could blame it on Egypt. The government of Lyndon Johnson and the Jewish media collaborated in a massive cover-up in order to avoid embarrassing Israel. That's what they're doing now in the case of the Israeli espionage ring that had advanced knowledge of September 11th, and also probably in the case of the anthrax letters. Circumstances beyond the control of the Jewish media and the Bush government may eventually force them to move against the anthrax mailer, however. We'll see. What's interesting in connection with this business of the media always putting Israel's interests ahead of America's interests and forcing our corrupt and treasonous government to do the same is the public attitude taken by the Jews in this country. They never apologize or act the least bit guilty or embarrassed. They always act as if they are the injured parties. Their arrogance and deceitfulness are simply beyond comprehension for the average Gentile. I'll give you just one example of that today by reading to you a few excerpts from a speech made last month by Abe Foxman, the national director of the country's most powerful Jewish pressure group, the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rit. This was a speech to his fellow Jewish insiders, and you can read the whole thing for yourself at the ADL's website. Foxman first said that he had hoped that the world would remember the special responsibility it has to the Jews because of the Holocaust. And then he said, and I quote, "My greatest nightmare is that one day I would wake up and something terrible would happen in America and we, the Jewish people, Jews and Israel, will be blamed." It happened. Today you can travel the Arab world, Asia and Europe, and read in newspapers and hear on radio and TV the big, hideous lie that has become a truth, that Jews bring about a situation in their interest in order to put the blame on somebody else. How classically anti-Semitic. Now, ministers of Arab governments and even newspapers in Western Europe have bought into the big lie. It has become a fact. It is being taught in the schools, that perversion of recent and current history. End of quote. The reaction they expect from the Gentiles, and it is the reaction they usually have gotten, is for the Gentiles to pull out their hankies and sniffle into them on behalf of the poor, innocent Jews being blamed and persecuted once again through no fault of their own. Well, you read for yourself all of Abe's speech at his ADL website. And I know that many of you will be much more inclined to gag than to sniffle. And the one encouraging aspect of this whole sordid situation is that more and more of the perceptive minority of our people around the world also are gagging instead of sniffling. Abe does indeed have reason to have nightmares, although it's not quite the reason he wants us to think it is. Thanks for being with me again today.